no robins on a roof. Going to go ahead and convene the Joint Interim Task Force on Primary and Mental Health Care Reimbursement. So I'd like to go ahead and begin this meeting with a round of introductions. We have a few members that are actually in transit, and then we have some on the phone. At this point, we'll go ahead and begin introductions. The meeting is recorded, and so we want to make sure we have a record of all the participants. So maybe we'll start to my left.
Sure. I'm John Lively, State Representative from Springfield.
Rick Kincaid from Eugene.
Sandy Teeley, Circus Staff.
Senator Tim Canope from Central Oregon.
Coralie Koning, Portland.
I'm Lisa Angus with the Health Authority's Office for Health Policy and Research, and just here for the first part of your agenda.
I'm Catherine Cushing, also with the Office of Health Policy and Research, and we're here to present to you guys today.
Thank you. And on the phone?
Mary Grant, Nurse Practitioner Co-Chair.
Any additional participants on the phone? Okay, well, we'll go ahead and proceed. I'd like to just review the agenda for a second and also recap what has led us to this point. Again, the 2902 set out a task for us to look at fair payment for services of nurse practitioners, PAs, and physicians, citing issues related to some payment disparity. And so we've been addressing that issue. In addition, we were also tasked to look at how we best support our workforce, and hence our guest today to talk about the workforce issues in primary care and behavioral health specifically, and those issues and how they relate to potential payment reform as a mechanism to support primary care and behavioral health. So that's sort of been our task. We've heard testimony over the last many months, and we're in the process of completing a report that will go to this session's legislature. And so this the discussion today is a work session where we're going to be looking at aspects of the report. So that's kind of where we are at and what the process is. Mary, did you want to add anything?
No, thank you, though.
Okay, very good. So to have a little bit deeper dive into the workforce questions, through our testimony, there was clear concern that we have some workforce issues across the state, providing particularly primary care and behavioral health in a variety of different types of jobs and roles that many providers have across the state. Has been areas, particularly with some of our geographic disparities in our rural communities, struggling to try to maintain a functional workforce. But even in some of our urban settings, we have challenges with certain demographics and being able to provide access to necessary services. So today, to have some discussion around what our workforce looks like, we have the pleasure of having Catherine Cushing and Lisa Angus with us to talk about healthcare workforce subcommittee of the Oregon Health Policy Board. And they've been deliberating for some time, and Catherine and Lisa will go through their actions and their findings thus far to help inform our discussion. Our recommendations had been to really pay attention to the work that's come out of this group. So we are pleased that you have been willing to come and share your findings and your process with us so far. So if you could start again, I know you introduced yourselves, but perhaps introduce yourselves and give us a little bit of a background with respect to your role and within the, so just to help to give a context with which you bring the information to the committee. So I'm going to hand it over to Catherine and Lisa, and I'll let you go forward.
Mary?
Yes.
If you can't hear Catherine and or Lisa, will you just give us the high sign so we can do some microphone adjusting?
Sure. Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks.
And have we had any additional people enter the phone line? Okay. Hearing none. Catherine, Lisa.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. We're very happy to be here today. As far as introductions, my name is Catherine Cushing. I am the workforce policy lead for our Office of Health Policy and Research within the Oregon Health Authority. I have been in this position for a little less than a year, and I'm so happy to be here. It's been a big learning curve for me, and it's been very exciting. Do you want to say
I'm Lisa Angus, also with the Office for Health Policy and Research. I run our policy development unit. Historically, I was the staff person, much as Sandy is your staff person, for the Healthcare Workforce Committee. Catherine has jumped into the fray now. And we're both here actually in place of Ann Buckley, who's the committee chair and was hoping to come this morning but had a last-minute contract negotiation something that came up, so was unable to make it. But she would have been happy to join you and answer questions, and we can always circle back with her if there's specific questions you have.
Okay, so to get started, just a little overview. We're going to talk to you today about the Healthcare Workforce Committee, as we mentioned, what the charter of the committee is, and talk about a few of the deliverables. We're going to talk about some of the upcoming Healthcare Workforce Committee projects and give you a little snapshot of what our healthcare workforce looks like through our Oregon Healthcare Workforce database. So first, just the Healthcare Workforce Committee. The Healthcare Workforce Committee began in 2009 along with the Oregon Health Policy Board. We are the only standing committee at this time of the Oregon Health Policy Board. We're chartered by the Health Policy Board. The charter is up here. We coordinate efforts to recruit, educate, and retain a quality healthcare workforce. And that is our main goal as a committee. We have about, I believe, 14 members now. Is that, I think I...
Close to.
And that we strive to have around, you know, between 12 and 15 members. Our membership is distributed among healthcare professionals and educational professionals, so that we have an intersection between those two fields, which seems to be a really important intersection to achieve. The Healthcare Workforce Committee is, as I said, chartered by the Oregon Health Policy Board, and the Health Policy Board sets our deliverables. We usually work on a deliverable for a year or two, depending on the depth of research that's needed for that. We deliver recommendations directly to the Health Policy Board, and we'll show you what some of those recommendations have been as we go forward. We're staffed by senior policy analysts, like Lisa or myself, and that's pretty much the committee overview for you.
Apologies. Catherine, could you just clarify what you consider healthcare workforce? It's sort of a definition of the scope of that evaluation. That would be very helpful. Maybe that's part of your discussion, but it would be really nice to know the sort of types of providers that you consider in your workforce.
Well, we talk about we have a broad definition of healthcare workforce. So we're talking about physicians, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, but also traditional health workers, community health workers, MAs, CNAs, the entire, we kind of run the gamut of worker who's going to be providing for our population, both now and in the future. So it's a fairly broad definition of workforce. Do you have anything to add to that?
No,
is that, does that answer your question?
Yeah, just again, the complexity of the healthcare delivery system requires just an unbelievable number of people to provide care, from whether it's people involved with registration functions, nursing functions, functions in the back office, front office, and then certainly in the hospital environment. So
that is absolutely
trying
true.
To understand the scope of your work.
Yes, the scope is broad.
I guess one thing I would add is, you know, we, like any committee, have sort of cyclical membership, but we've tried to keep an array of folks. We've actually just added some, so someone to represent public health. We have behavioral and physical health providers. We had at one point an addiction specialist that we don't have at the moment, so we have tried to sort of keep a broad. We're bringing on someone who's got some expertise in telemedicine and the sort of workforce issues that relate to that. So the committee has sort of tried to talk about workforce as a whole. Obviously, there's specific issues that impact specific professions differently, but they've tried to keep sort of true to their charge to think about what Oregon needs as a workforce overall, rather than one particular discipline versus another.
Okay, so on to some of the deliverables that we have produced in the recent past. Our deliverables often take the form of reports, so I'm going to talk to you about a few reports that we have just recently given to the Oregon Health Policy Board. I think I'm going to let Lisa start on that, and then I will pick up in the middle.
Lisa, before you begin, we've had a couple of additional community members. Just want to identify yourselves. So
Rep. Julie Parrish.
Robin Henderson.
So two examples on the side that I'll just talk about briefly. One request we get frequently is, how many more health professionals do we need? Of what type, and when is this need coming? And it's a little obviously hard to answer exactly, but we were asked to by the policy board to think about what are the projected need for healthcare professionals, particularly in the context of the fact that everyone's trying to change the model of care. This is obviously not an exact science. But what we did is took data regarding utilization of healthcare from the state's All Payer All Claims database, adjusted that by, this was in 2013, so it was before we knew who would gain insurance, but we had projections about who would gain insurance. And we used data we have from the workforce database that we'll talk in a little minute to say how many health professionals, broadly speaking, are currently providing care that meets this utilization, you know, to match this utilization. We projected that forward through 2020. And then tried to make some adjustments based on what we know from the literature about how might that utilization and demand change if, for instance, there's a much greater adoption of electronic health records, or if the division of care shifts away from physicians more and more towards NPs and PAs. So we ran a bunch of scenarios. And the intent was not to arrive at the right number, but to say, here's how the demand could vary under a range of sort of plausible scenarios. So that was a report that we delivered to the Health Policy Board in January, I believe. And we have with us, I think, a couple physical copies of each of these, but all of them are posted on that website. So that's a report projection. Another of the deliverables we did for the Policy Board was to look at what does the workforce look like in terms of diversity, so race, ethnicity, languages spoken largely, and how does that compare to Oregon's population. We ran into a little bit of difficulty. The workforce data is still sort of maturing and developing, and there's a good chunk of missing data still for race and ethnicity, so getting to an absolute conclusion was difficult. But we were able to do some comparisons by a geography and to provide some little snapshots of the people who do identify as providers of color. What are the most common professions among Asian American healthcare professionals? Compare that. So we have, that's just sort of a short data snapshot. We have that available as well.
Okay, and the other two we have listed up here. We just recently developed a policy options memo on expanding graduate medical education. Graduate medical education are residencies for those who are not quite up on that language yet, but we need to expand residencies for newly graduated physicians. So that we can attract more physicians to the right parts of Oregon and practicing in the types of specialties that we need. So this policy options memo looked at four different options for doing that, and the committee decided that the most workable option would be to develop a primary care residency consortium, which means bringing a bunch of folks together from the community, from the place where or the places where we feel that a new primary care residency might be really useful, and determining how best to go about developing that residency with the input of those community members and stakeholders. We are experiencing a lot of success in that area. It looks like we have some startup funding dedicated to do that, and that will get us a long way toward actually developing this consortium. So that's pretty exciting. Another recent report that we delivered was on the financial incentive programs for providers in Oregon. There's quite a wide array of incentives for providers. In fact, one of the things that this report was able to find was that we have a broader array of supports available than most states. So that's pretty exciting. That's great. A recommendation is that we look more closely at those incentives and make sure that they are coordinated and are working well together, and also to collect more data about effectiveness and the outcomes that we have produced because of those financial incentives. So that's kind of a brief overview of some of our recent reports. Any more questions about those?
Hello, who just joined us on the phone?
Hi, it's John Passis from Regents.
Welcome, John, thank you.
Sorry I'm late.
No problem.
That's okay, thanks for joining us. We also have an additional committee member that joined us.
Janine Smith, Chief Medical Officer, Oregon Health Authority.
Thank you, Dr. Smith.
One question. On your graduate medical education, have you ever considered any of the residencies for the physician assistant as well?
That wasn't in the scope of this particular analysis, but it doesn't mean that it might not be in the scope of the consortium. It kind of depends upon those members and how broad they would like to how broad they'd like to work. Chances are it will be focused on physicians, though.
Okay. Was there an assessment of the adequacy of training programs for particularly primary care nurse practitioners through any of your discussions, making sure that we had enough training with respect to other providers, kind of tag on to Coralie's question?
Well, we do have a report coming up. We're going to run into a slide on that in just a few minutes, but we are looking at some of the emerging trends and whether or not we have the educational capacity to keep up with those trends. We aren't looking specifically at our capacity to fill those roles that are already established, like nurse practitioners, with the exception of, you know, trying to figure out what our demand is in the future. You know, the training programs exist. Do we have enough? Well, it kind of depends on how many do we need. So it's a little bit of a chicken and an egg thing. The committee is definitely looking at it and working on it. We don't have a report in the works right now, though, that's going to investigate that more closely, as far as I know. No.
I just think it's important to note that, you know, really much like residency programs, sort of the specialization level of nurse practitioners and PAs, actually, and how additional training is necessary to be able to accomplish those, in whether it's geriatrics, pediatrics, behavioral health, a whole variety of other venues where specialty training is necessary.
Right. Well, one of the things that this financial incentives report looks at, incentives are generally put in place to draw physicians either and nurse practitioners and physician assistants to either areas that need them that already have health professional shortages as determined by the federal government or in specialties that are needed. So in a way, you can look at the financial incentive report and kind of get an idea, hey, this is where we're short on people, this is where we might need a little bit more help. And some of those financial incentive programs actually help pay back loans and provide scholarships for practitioners who are entering those needed fields or going to those needed areas. Again, that doesn't speak specifically to the training that's in place right now for them, but it does speak to the need to encourage and incentivize where they practice. Anything else on this one? Okay. So I thought it might be interesting. I know it doesn't specifically speak to your work here in this committee, but I thought you'd like to see that the Healthcare Workforce Committee actually has a lot of success in being able to implement some of the recommendations that they deliver to the Health Policy Board. So these are just three examples of recommendations that have gone from the recommendation stage into the implementation stage. One is streamlining administrative requirements for health profession students in clinical rotations. This kind of speaks to, well, actually all of these speak to your question about how broad is the scope of the committee. One of the things that the committee discovered was that students who are going into clinical rotations, students who are, for example, studying to be medical assistants or CNAs or pharmacy technicians,
folks like that, they often do more than one rotation, and often those clinical sites that they are going into are asking them to produce different sorts of administrative requirements every time they go. So the committee felt that it would be important to streamline those administrative requirements so there'd be less of a burden on students. That did happen. A law passed in 2012, and the Oregon Health Authority, with a stakeholder committee, developed the Oregon Administrative Rule 409030, and it went into effect. I know that number. Yeah, it went into effect July 1st, and we are in the process of implementing right now. So that's great. That's been a great step forward for those students. We also recommended, the committee recommended, that we needed statewide certification requirements for traditional health workers. That led eventually to the establishment of the Traditional Health Worker Commission, which is in operation right now and in the process of developing both those standards and a registry of traditional health workers, and really helping them get their feet in the door for jobs.
Do you have an idea who will provide the oversight for that group of providers?
For the commission?
Well, for the providers themselves, ongoing. Once there's a sort of a certification process, who does that fall under?
So the Oregon Health Authority's Office of Equity and Inclusion hosts this commission. The commission certifies training programs and says, okay, if you've gone through this training program, or if you're grandfathered into it under various scenarios, this sort of meets their certification standards. If you're asking who sort of supervises them in a clinical setting or on the ground, I think it can vary quite a bit. So I'm not sure which.
I guess who provides oversight for, we have the medical board that provides oversight and monitoring to make sure you're maintaining education, maintaining certification, et cetera, over time. Same sort of, I'm just wondering who actually for the, because it's a broad group, the traditional health workers, a broad group, not just the community health workers, but other peer support specialists, et cetera. So, Who is it, the commission that actually provides that ongoing certification oversight?
Yes, with the distinction that this is not it's not at the level of a license and it's not required. So you've certified, if you're trying to, for instance, get Medicaid reimbursement, you have to be certified and part of the registry that they're building. But it's akin to, there's a variety of medical professionals and paraprofessionals who don't have a license. And there's a standards body, and there's a set of expectations. It functions a little differently than, say, the Board of Nursing or something at that level. But
and there's a specific license. Okay.
Yeah.
One question on the Traditional Health Worker Commission is that those are the ones that you identified in your workforce identifications. Is that huge, broad amount, or is there a difference between a non-traditional and a traditional health worker?
That's probably a huge question.
But also the nomenclature has changed a little over time, so it's been hard to keep up with.
So the commission is talking about traditional health workers. Mm-hmm. That phrase at this time includes, and I hope I'm going to get them all right, I may not, community health workers, peer-delivered services, people who are generally in the behavioral health field, mm-hmm. Doulas.
I think that's all, Julia. Peer support, peer wellness specialist, there's a distinction.
Yeah, peer support specialist and peer wellness specialist, yeah.
Community health workers, doulas. Yep.
So those are included under that phrase now, traditional health workers. That doesn't mean there aren't others who consider themselves traditional health workers, and rightfully so, but they aren't necessarily going to be included in this group unless it expands in the future. Okay, the third one that I wanted to point out, one of the recommendations of the Healthcare Workforce Committee was to level the playing field for public and private education institutions. And what had happened was, I'm not sure when the law passed, but there was a law on the books that kind of required public institutions to take a back seat to private institutions that wanted to establish new health profession programs. That probably made sense when it was put into place, but with the rising need for more professionals, it made less sense over time. It was a real stumbling block for our public institutions to create new programs to, get new workers on board. And as a result, the adverse impact law was repealed in 2013. So we feel that was a real success as well. The report I was talking about, the upcoming report that's on the books, we call it the Emerging Trends Report. It's an analysis of healthcare industry trends in emerging employment categories, also talking about what education is in place in order to fill those needs as they are coming on board. It's, as I'm sure this committee understands, a pretty tricky job to figure out what is actually emerging, because things are seem to be changing daily. So every day I go into that report to try to finish it up, I am adding things. So it's quite a challenge to figure that out with our climate of health reform. But that is on the in the queue and will be turned into the Health Policy Board on November 1st. Questions about that?
Just one in that. Do you anticipate, as part of your recommendations, any specific legislative actions coming out related to these topics?
Not in this case. The Emerging Trends Report, I can't think of anything that would be legislative. No.
Or status report and, and what to anticipate in the future.
Correct. And Lisa's going to take over here for the healthcare workforce database.
Yeah, so just two brief slides. One of the things that happened at the same piece of legislation that created the health authority and created the health policy board was the creation of a healthcare workforce database that's populated as with data collected as healthcare professionals renew their licensure. The original legislation in 2009 asked or required that 7 boards participate. They're listed here, so the some of the largest boards and the major healthcare professionals. The way the data is collected is to, when someone goes in to renew their license, for most boards this happens electronically. They jump out to a short survey that we've created and answer questions about demographic characteristics, you know, age, gender, race, ethnicity, and so on. And answer some questions about practice characteristics. You know, what specialty area, what kind of setting do you practice in? Do you plan to retire in the next 2 years? Those kind of things. We have 7 mandatory boards since 2009. I'm sure this group is aware most professionals, not all, renew their licensure every other year. So that's sort of as often as we get a new data point. We've also been working. The committee in particular has been really interested in collecting more data from behavioral health professionals, and those boards were not named in the original legislation. We've been working with them since 2011 on a voluntary basis, which means the professionals in the mandatory group are required to at least go through this questionnaire before renewing their license. These folks are asked to participate voluntarily. We probably get about a third of them in terms of response rate at this point. So the data there are less complete, but we are starting to try and build that. And across those, we have about 21 professions represented. And we are getting to the point now, by the end of last year and the renewals that are happening this year, to have almost 3 data points across time for those boards. So there's a list of some of the kinds of data we collected that I just mentioned. We are slowly moving towards making the data more comparable. Obviously, every board has historically asked some kinds of these questions differently because they represent their particular profession. We are trying to get to the point where we can compare it across boards. And we have every other year, twice so far, we call it a trend when there's 3 of them. So by the time we hit January, we will have the trend of putting out a report every other year that sort of summarizes the information across these boards. We were happy to get you the one that was in early 2012, but I thought you might be more interested in waiting for the one that comes out early 2014, and which will have more recent data. All of these reports will have 3 main sections, just sort of what are the statewide trends over time, what's the picture look like for these boards, knowing that, you know, we have a large group, but we certainly aren't representing every healthcare professional, much less the professionals who are active and provide a ton of care but are not required to be licensed. We also have an occupational profile set, you know, so among registered nurses, what does the practice setting distribution look like, what are their retirement plans and so on. And then we have a statewide and county by county profile page for each county. So here's the number of professionals in these disciplines and other information to sort of give a comparative snapshot between different geographies. We will have some maps in there as well. And so that is anticipated. We're working with contractors now on that, and it should be available in January of 2014.
And can I just add one thing about this, this database?
2015. Oh, God, 2015.
2015,
yes, I'm
that's
sorry.
Right. Lisa's very modest. She doesn't say this as often as I think she should, but this is fantastic data that very few states have. As I've been doing the research, I've found that I actually think Oregon has the most complete data set about their healthcare workforce of any state in our country. So it's a place where we're really on the forefront. I get calls periodically asking me to talk about this and how did you ever get people to do this? So it was it's kind of an amazing data set. It's giving us fantastic information, and I think it'll be very, very helpful in the future, especially for committees like this one trying to figure out, you know, how do we really work with the workforce in a way that's going to be productive and helpful in the future. So I'm sorry,
Janine, I just wanted to add that there is some consideration for a possible legislative concept of, if you go back that slide, the professions that are only voluntary, is there a way that we could get perhaps better data because when they're not, you know, only a third are providing, and also just to support the work of gathering this data because they're also not contributing to the cost. The other ones are. So the nursing, we're in partnership with the nursing and medical boards to pull all this data together, and the Oregon Workforce Institute as well. But there is some thought about how could you make this even a little better to better capture the full workforce, because it's really valuable when people, I know even the committee members of the commission have asked, like, well, I'm having these issues in my area, and we can go into the database and really see really what's going on in that community. The historically, before House Bill 2009 put this in, you were left with 2-, 3-, 4-year-old data nationally collected that was only a few of the professions and not very useful. Or you have to go out through survey, which is much, much more expensive than just linking off of the licensing. So,
yeah, I think the I'm not sure what part of it came to you as a group, but early on in this task force had asked for some look by county. So those data we pulled from the workforce database. So that, you know, the more this matures, the more people are in it, the more valuable it becomes.
Just in the era of big data being such a so important, is there a vision beyond perhaps what Dr. Smith was talking about to you know, expand the sort of function to other parts of the workforce that support these professions? So you kind of, your example of a pharmacy tech or a MP, is there a plan to expand, to begin to look at, as you try to inform training programs for the people that are going to be necessary to support these folks, is there a sense of or a mechanism to do that other than survey? Is there a way to look at employers or businesses and who they employ and those types of numbers? Is there any thought about that?
There are some good ways to connect those. I mean, so there's an easy, it's straightforward compared to other mechanisms to collect data for people who have to get licensed because they have to, you know, show up every so often and reattest. For people who aren't required to be licensed, it's a little more difficult. You have to go find them. The employment department does a ton of great work around collecting, data based on unemployment tax records and so on. And they collect a whole wealth of data around some professions that aren't represented in here because they're not licensed. The data look a little different, and they follow the federal system of standard occupational codes and so on. But that's another way to get at a fuller picture of the workforce. Another way we've tried to sort of, I'm not sure if I call it big data, but it's fun data, that we've tried to sort of enhance the value of this is connect it to other data sets. So the projections report that I talked about earlier was a direct way to link the All Payer, All Claims database and this database to say, here's some utilization from claims data, here's the total number of health professionals we know in certain disciplines from this data set. How does that match up? How much, you know, what FTE is representing this utilization? So I think we're sort of building on the value of it in addition to thinking about expansion by thinking about connections.
You know, one of the things that the All Payer, All Claims database is absolutely great. What I wonder is how fast it's able to keep up with the new trends that are coming out in all of this. Mm-hmm. When you look at the patient-centered medical home and the addition of community health workers and behavioral health consultants and all those other folks, sometimes those codes aren't A, consistent across CCOs, and B, they aren't really utilized because some practices just throw it in there and say we're going to do this. Same thing with RNCCs, you know, nurse care coordinators. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I don't have a great answer for you for how we collect that, but I do think that we have some work to do in terms of data capture, especially in the range of codes that we're able to capture. And I hope that there's maybe your folks can put some creative thought into how we do that from some of those leading places, because I worry about when we create ratios based on the all payer, all claims database, knowing what I know about where healthcare is going, knowing what I know about where utilization is going, that I wonder if maybe there's companion surveys of tier 3 PCPCHs and what people are actually doing as a comparative.
Yeah,
just a thought.
I agree. I mean, every data source has its limitations, and you know, so you have to get to the point where you can try and create a composite picture, even if you can't directly link from A to B to C, but to think what the overall picture gets to.
And, you know, Robin brings up a key point. You know, how do you sort of skate to where the puck's going? So it's I think that our challenge as we really look at the healthcare delivery model is one of making sure that we have the workforce necessary to support the model. Because certainly when I started in family medicine practice 30 years ago, you know, I had a single nurse and a front desk person. And now I have a team of, last count was 10 different people that connect with my patients over the course of the day, just in my care team. So the care model has shifted, and with that, how do we assure that we have the support necessary, because we don't have enough primary care providers in order to really do the level of care that's necessary without really engaging a broader team-based approach model. So very curious how you balance that projection, workforce projection, with sort of that model of care shift. It's a challenging dance.
Yeah, it's a key thing that the workforce committee always struggles with. How do you say how many people you need when the model of care is changing under your feet? Mm-hmm. And as a Canadian, I'd very much appreciate your hockey analogy, so thank you. one of the ways, there's no easy answer to that, one of the ways the committee has historically talked about it is to try and focus less on what type of professional and what title it is to what functions do we need to see answered, and so to talk about what are the competencies that people, that educational programs need to focus on as they're training. Mm-hmm. Who cares what the person is called, but what are the sort of functions you need to provide collectively across the workforce to get to that model? With that, there's certainly no magic bullet.
Well, one of the interesting things the projections report does, I think, is it analyzes the issue based on utilization of electronic health records. How might that change things? Utilization of team-based care. How might that change things? So you have some different numbers based on how that analysis was done, as opposed to this is what we think is going to be needed. No, it's this is what we think is going to be needed if you take these various elements into account. So it's kind of I think it's a pretty interesting report that way, and it has a depth of analysis that I don't think you see all the time. So
it's commendable. Clearly the influence of health information systems and really that information technology piece, expansion of decision support tools that are available, will be available on an increasing basis for each and every individual. I don't think I have hardly a single patient that doesn't have a smartphone that's under the age of maybe 80. Reality is that you have information at your fingertips, which also influences how much care is necessary and then what actions you take. So I appreciate that you're looking at that technology piece because, again, I think we're going to have to solve a lot of our care model challenges with not just more workforce, but actually a better equipped workforce, and leveraging technology will be an important component of that.
And there's a degree to which the consumer is part of the healthcare workforce. I mean, the more, not only with the smartphone, you know, Wikipedia lookup of your medical condition, but the more you get patients involved in their care, the more, you know, they're sort of part of that health promotion workforce. So.
Mary or John, do you have additional questions for Catherine and Lisa?
No, I don't.
John?
No, I don't.
Catherine or Lisa, when you guys talked about the finance, that Oregon was kind of ahead of the curve on the incentive programs, kind of in what area have we been thinking outside the box to attract or, you know, to provide the incentives? Or, I mean, are we being creative with our incentive programs compared to other states? Or is it just that we implement them quicker or more?
I'll take the first swipe at that. One of the things that the analysis found was that we offer a wider array of incentive programs than most states. And one of the things that studies have found in the past is that they tend to be better utilized when there are more options. So the assumption there is we're going to have people utilizing these programs. We're going to draw more people because we have more options for them. Are they more creative? That I don't know. I mean, you know, they're scholarship programs or loan repayment programs. I don't know. Is there a creative element there that I'm kind of missing? Or
I don't think anything that is not something that someone else doesn't do somewhere. But so Oregon has tax credits, loan forgiveness, loan repayment, and some direct incentive programs too. So the array is broader. I know. It's a very useful report. I don't know if you guys want to get in this level of detail, but it has an appendix that sort of lists out each of the programs in Oregon and the different qualifying criteria. And I'm sure you're all aware that there's a different legislative and sort of advocate work group that's been looking at how do you get a handle on all these financial incentives and whether you ought to put more investment in financial incentive program A versus B. So part of the report is talking about let's try and get a consistent set of data on how these programs are operating and the degree to which they're being effective so you can make those decisions over time.
And this report was presented to that task force. So
thanks.
I was gonna say I've seen that report with the different incentives, and I think it was basically through the Oregon Society of PAs. We kind of have our hands into every one of the areas here. So I've seen that, and I thought maybe we had seen it, but I don't think we've seen it in this workforce.
So we should have a couple copies on hand, and then it's also online. It's really we're happy helpful. To send it electronically if that helps.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You gave us the link. And
okay, and I do have these hard copies. Can I just put them on the back table in case people want to pick them up? Or?
Sure. Does okay. anybody?
That would be perfect.
Okay.
We haven't totally gone paperless here, have we?
No. No, this is Oregon. We support the wood products industry.
Okay.
So how do... as you have looked at that effectiveness piece, are there recommendations that come out of that to either accelerate one program or decelerate another, or do they do with that data?
Not yet. So the recommendation was really to look consistently at that effectiveness piece. Some programs have been able to do it more than others. So the sort of first stage is to look at it, to do a comparable look at it across programs. One recommendation that was in that report is for the legislature to potentially think of a flexible pot of funding. One of the things about, you know, incentive programs are created usually with the best of intentions, you know, to create a particular need that's known at that time. As you guys have talked a lot about, the demand for workforce functions and skills changes rapidly. So, later on, 5-10 years down the road, you still have a program that's sort of defined very specifically around this need. So there was a recommendation to consider maybe taking, you know, a little percent off the funding for the existing programs to stick in a more flexible pot that could respond year to year from demands. So that's one potential way an interim step to involve some flexibility before you get to a more comprehensive picture around effectiveness.
One other area that was called out in earlier testimony was foreign medical graduates and whether or not there could be barriers or challenges for foreign medical graduates to come to the state and practice. So I didn't know if that was something that you also look at as sort of some of those potential barriers, or are there any or not, or what group would actually be looking at? That was something that was brought up as a concern from, I believe, the Medical Association. So felt that there were still some challenges.
We do have a group within the Office for Health Policy and Research, the state's primary care office, and they're the ones who administer the J-1 visa waiver program. They've had a recent look via some contractors at retention of people who come in via that mechanism that we can share with you. They would be a good group to look at potential barriers. And I'm assuming that, or I guess the question is asking for non-U.S. citizens who come to practice, not U.S. citizens who may do medical school mm-hmm. abroad. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Many of our rural environments are very dependent on the J-1 visa population of foreign graduates. So it's just want to make sure that, you know, we can try to retain as many as possible, because one of the challenges certainly in small rural hospitals is these folks are only there for a very short time, and then all of a sudden you have a big hole again, and then how do you just kind of keep sort of a transient population of providers. So are there ways to try to keep providers within the state? I'm glad that there's some look at that retention piece. Any other additional questions? John? Okay, I want to thank you both very much for a very good report. We will definitely push out the report, make sure that the whole comprehensive report, particularly the predictive report, I think would be very helpful for us to sort of look at, how you envision that. Again, our task is really to look at primary care and behavioral health workforce and make sure that there's good support. It sounds like there's a good database to actually look at what that looks like, how you blend that with the predictive model as to where we need to go. That, I think, that's the challenge that we all have. And so our role is to try to make sure there is good oversight, make sure that we are actively pursuing ways to enhance our workforce. So thank you very much for
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you. It's fun to see people who love data. It's really fun to get excited about data. That's
us.
Individuals exist. Yeah.
So I actually have those projections here if anybody wants to look at those that they were talking about on the different things. And I think they also have one on the different reimbursements as well. So. They're in here as well.
And we'll just make sure, Corley, if we don't already have that link pushed out, we'll just make sure everybody can access that data.
Yeah. I'll make sure.
Take a look at that. Because I think it's helpful as we build our rapport to make sure, are we as a state really shepherding that ability to have the right providers with the right level of training and the right balance. I think we want to try to make sure that that is indeed the case. So,
It also has the different incentives that they have as well. The whole, it's kind of in a table form as to how we compare to other states and everything. It's quite detailed what they put together. So.
Very good. I think as a provider, oftentimes it's somewhat confusing, to be honest, and because there is an array, who's eligible for what, and that is still not a real clear process, sort of probably akin to the, Cover Oregon Exchange or something where you're trying to answer questions with, with programs. So anyway, hopefully that discussion was helpful as we looked at the workforce. The next item on the agenda is to really one of the questions that was brought up as we did a little bit deeper dive into the recommendations last time, and we were fortunate enough to have the Department of Consumer and Business Services with us, pointed out some of the challenges in the definition of an independent practice provider. And so Jack Dempsey has been kind enough to come and give some thoughts as the Oregon Nurses Association has taken a little closer look at sort of this definition and then to have some discussion. And then we also have an accompanying document. Hopefully, folks got that came from Jeanette Holman, which they had come up with some potential suggestions around some possible language change. So, Jack, as you're going through, try to give a sense of and I'm sure you've looked at that, how we can make sure that there's clarity. One of the things that we had requested last time of the board is that we begin to have a really a surveillance mechanism to make sure we are actually looking at the population that's been challenged by some of the payment reimbursement disparity, and making sure that actions have been effective in addressing that group. So we want to make sure the definition of the group is the right definition, and also that it encompasses the intention of the original legislation. So those of you that were involved with that discussion can add more information. So Jack, if you could introduce yourself, your role, and then help us with this discussion.
Yeah, thank you very much. My name is Jack Dempsey. I'm a lobbyist for the Oregon Nurses Association. I appreciate you letting me testify today and including this issue in your report, where it talks about clarifying the definition of independent practice. Why this has come up, just to give you the background, is that we've discovered one insurance company in particular has taken a literal definition of the legislation and has such not applied this legislation to its nurse practitioners that bill under that company. So right now, the definition of independent practice in law essentially says nurse practitioners and PAs that bill for services using their own name and their own national provider identifier. When you fill out your health insurance claim form, right at the bottom here are three parts. One is your name, one's your provider identifier, and then the third one is your clinic identifier. There are some insurance companies that require smaller independent practices to bill under their clinic identifier. You know, even if you're a nurse practitioner in solo practice, this company is requiring you to bill under your clinic, and as such, then they have said that this legislation does not cover them. We think that's the wrong intent of this legislation, but as such, that's how this has been interpreted by them and the insurance division. So what I think is the simplest way to rectify that is to essentially say, you know, you bill under your own name, your own provider identifier, or your clinic identifier. In my interpretation, I don't believe that that restricts any of the EMPs or PAs that was covered by this, and I also don't believe that it expands it to anybody that's not currently covered by this. So that is our suggestion. We, as an organization, are not interested in you know, going back last session and rehashing this definition and try to limit the folks that are covered by this. The recommendation from the insurance division was an amendment that was ultimately not adopted by the legislature. Just looking at their three points that they identify here under A, B, and C, to me, A and C are pretty similar and I think get to the same intent. B, where it talks about not working directly with a physician, just a couple instances that come to mind in my head. There's a small practice in Central Oregon that I've worked with that is co-owned by a physician and a nurse practitioner. The physician is in the process of trying to retire and turn his panel completely over to a nurse practitioner. In that instance, that person would not be covered. Another one is there is a nurse practitioner-owned clinic in Portland that actually employs a physician, and under my read of that, that person would not be covered. So just working with a physician, you know, to me sets us back. You know, adding where I say we should just add, you know, or a clinic identifier, whether we add a clinic identifier of a clinic owned by a PA or MP, is something we may consider. I'm a little hesitant to say yes on that because I haven't had conversations with our physician assistant colleagues, and I don't know how their clinics are organized. But that might be one option. But like I said, I think the simplest way is just to add or clinic MPI. So that would be our recommendation. I'm open to discussion or answer any questions.
So, Jack, when you say clinic identifier, so I'm just trying to understand the connection, why there wouldn't be a clinic identifier, or why if there is, it's a problem. So, you know, so they work in a practice someplace. So that practice may not be part of a clinic or maybe part of another clinic? I mean, I'm trying to understand.
There's always a clinic MPI associated with where a provider does that procedure.
Right.
That is, I'm going to guess, almost always identified in the claim form. Why this has come up is because a particular insurance company has said, because the law says you have to bill under your personal MPI, some clinics bill under their clinic MPI. And as such, they don't believe that that's covered under that.
Covered in.
So they're billing under their business license rather than
exactly.
as an individual. Oh. So it's probably for tax purposes, et cetera.
To be honest, from the couple folks that I've talked to around this, the insurance company requires them to bill that way. And that's why they do that. Not all insurance companies, in my understanding, require that, and some actually bill under their own name in the same practice, just for different plans.
Depending on what plan wants right. what.
Yeah. John, I hope you, or you know if you're still on the phone, but it'd be nice to know sort of the why. Why would an insurer require a clinic identifier as a and not the individual identifier?
To be honest with you, I don't know how to answer that. I probably am not that close to the details.
The only other thing
I can find out and get back to you. And I don't know. To be honest with you, I don't even know what our practice is. So, I don't know if we're the guilty party on that, but I could find out and get back to you.
I suppose if they're getting a patient-centered primary care home incentive payment, and they're certified based on the site and not by the provider. There would, you know, if you're getting a PMPM case management fee to a PCPCH, it might be why, but.
It might be that. It might be a credentialing issue because they credential the clinic as opposed to the individual providers,
right.
which makes it easier when you have providers coming in and
or
out.
Or it's a satellite mm-hmm. off of a main clinic sort
but
of thing.
But in any event, it shouldn't preclude, I mean, it shouldn't create the situation they're dealing with. That seems like a little bit of that nitpicky thing.
I mean, where this came up initially was a clinic where there is one nurse practitioner provider that has owned that clinic for many years that is told that this legislation does not cover them. So I think I would agree with Ms. Henderson that it becomes kind of a nitpicky type thing that I think goes against the intent of what this was.
The language from the insurance division, number B, I mean, in order to bill for Medicare, I think they do have to partner, PAs is a whole nother,
yeah.
is one ball of wax onto
We're partners
itself.
No matter what. Yeah.
You have to partner with a doc. Mm-hmm. But so it almost would preclude PAs just with this language. And then Medicare, I know, doesn't recognize independent nurse nurse practitioners, and so if you have a Medicare patient, you often have to have some affiliation with a doc in order to bill, right?
I don't think you need an affiliation to bill. I think they just bill at 85%.
Ability. Well, I thought.
Too. I
thought independent. They couldn't be totally anyway.
Does Mary know?
Maybe.
Mary, did you hear that? To get Medicare reimbursement?
Yeah, I do, but I just get it at 85%.
Okay. Oh, you just get 85%. Yeah. Okay. I was thinking that you couldn't even bill at all. So.
Yeah, we didn't need a physician. We just billed at 85.
Okay.
Because when I went to work for a group of physicians, they said it would be better for her to bill under us, under the physician or independent. Didn't matter. Either way, it was 85%.
So the sense is that in the recommendations that came to us from the insurance division, that B, the second piece of that is would be challenging.
Absolutely.
And I was trying to figure out what working directly with actually what that meant.
Well, if you'd like to know on the physician assistant side, direct supervision means the supervising physician is in the facility at the time that the PA is working. Basically, Providence Portland is having their PAs sign now as being directly supervised every time they log into Epic. So, though I've had some issues about that being completely correct, but that's how we're all signing in. Most PAs are generally supervised where they are not in the same facility. We're only by telephonic or some kind of communications connection to our supervising physicians.
So in a situation where, kind of use that other example, if you were a PA and you actually employed the physician, are you able to then bill?
That's a tricky, tricky question, and I'm going to have to actually defer that to maybe, I mean, I'm going to have to actually find out how that is actually handled, because I don't have the answer to that right now.
Because I think as you, you know, as we look forward, I mean, you start to look at how are you going to care for, particularly in rural environments, there may be situations in which, you know, the PA actually employs the physician.
There are those cases.
To the other way around.
There are those cases. I'm just not quite sure how they're handling the billing apps. I haven't been able to wrap my mind around it yet. So I'll try to get that together and get it back to you on that.
So I Mr. Dempsey has pointed out the need for the or language, so to speak, or the and or language with respect to that. And so what we can do is go back and really look at how to construct a recommendation around that clarification. Because I do think that it has been a challenge, certainly for the insurance division, to figure out who exactly are we talking about. And so I think getting clarity around that will be very helpful, certainly as they create a surveillance tool for us to be able to look at that. And we also need to understand the impact. You know, is this two people? Is it 1,000 providers? Is it, you know, we have to try to understand the relative impact that it has on those environments. The challenge is that to that one person, it's a huge impact. So, we need to basically understand that, though.
I think we're just now trying to get a sense of how far and wide that is, and because the law is rolling out, folks are starting to understand what's under that. I don't think we have great data at this point.
I do know of one particular PA who does own his own practice, and I've been kind of wanting to find out how they would feel about coming and testifying, but if that's something you would find interesting or helpful, I can actually ask him and see what he says.
Oh, and it may be helpful even to get a statement around, you know, how they view the billing function and if they've had barriers to reimbursement.
Okay.
Because, again, I think the whole purpose of this is try to take down the barriers that are affecting access or ability for a practitioner to effectively deliver care in their community.
Yeah, so I guess I'll just reiterate. I believe that the simplest way to fix the problem that we're seeing is to add an or a clinic MPI. I think if you wanted to look at just number C from the insurance division where you add just a clinic MPI of a clinic owned by an MP or PA, we would consider that, but keep in mind, I believe that does restrict who is currently covered by this. If you're in a clinic owned by a physician, those folks would be restricted back.
And I'll get back to you on some of the billing issues for the PA as well.
And again, for those of you that were here to talk openly with you, that were involved in the original discussions around this issue, trying to understand, are we actually focusing on the right group? So I just want to make sure that it was the intention to really make sure that we're looking at a fairly defined group of individuals. And so, you know, those of you that were involved in that original legislature, I want to just make sure the original intent is met.
Right.
Feel confident that's the case?
Yeah, I mean, I believe the original intent of this legislation was to cover nurse practitioners that bill under their own name, that carry their own line of patients, and are not billing incident to a physician. There was a lot of conversation during this debate, whereas you shouldn't be working with the physician, that ultimately was not accepted, that you should only be in an NP-owned clinic, and that was ultimately not accepted. So I think we landed on a definition that we were happy with, and it's just been the strict interpretation of this that has caused an issue with one particular plan.
Very good. Well, what we can do is come back with a language recommendation to that effect. That would, and then what the process would be from there. So we can bring that back at our next meeting. So, any other questions for Mr. Dempsey? Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for coming, and we appreciate your input. Okay, the next item on the agenda, and for really the remainder of the time we're here, Senator Knope, I believe, has to leave a little bit early. And so one of the issues I did want to bring up is our future meeting schedule to make sure that everybody can meet that. In our discussions, Mary and Sandy and I, we felt that perhaps looking at a meeting schedule that was sort of an every other month meeting would be a little bit more doable, particularly given the workload of the legislators and those of us have day jobs. So our proposal was to meet again in November, considering sort of the next section, the payment reform section. We're going to talk a little bit more right now about the workforce section. And then finalize what we would consider potentially a data call for the insurance division, try to bring that together and make some recommendations so we can get some clarity on that. We'll also bring back the language related to independent practitioners. And then we felt that we would then meet again in January to complete basically the report to the legislature and have a final approval. Now, in between, we can do a lot of virtual discussion and editing, et cetera, but our intention really would be at the January meeting to finalize the report going forth to the legislature. And then if there are legislative concepts or other types of things that come out of that, making sure that those are, if there are, that those are also available at that time. So just wanted to get a sense from the group if it was okay rather than this monthly. It's been really challenging for most of our schedules to try to do this at this frequency, and especially with the session, if it would be okay to spread it out. I wanted to open that up to the group.
Works for me.
Yep, sounds great.
Go back to seeing patients on Friday morning. Providing access.
Anybody who's providing access at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes for a very busy afternoon, I will tell you that.
Question I had is what happens after January then? What's any thought? Would we be completed our task for the time being and reevaluate going at some future point?
Well, our sense, and certainly the rest of the discussions that Mary can chime in, is that that we have more work to do, and that we would probably reconvene, depending on the schedule of the legislature, probably April, I think is what Sandy was thinking, either March or April, reconvene. We'll also give us an idea at that point around what's actually happening, what is actively going on in the legislature, so that will give us a sense of perhaps where some of the issues may even be that we've addressed or at least called out, maybe actually in process to being sort of solutions found. Want to kind of bring in some of that tie, what's actually happening that could influence that outcome. And so that was our sense, was to bring the group back together in either March or April, but again, not in February, kind of doing a sort of every other month approach. Sound reasonable?
Well, and then the data call, you know, if you come up with the data call for the insurance division, they'll, you know, get that's going to take a little bit of time, get it put together, then you could like evaluate it in the spring meeting or something like that. Because I'm not sure if
we'll at least have
a January.
Baseline. We should have a baseline data at that point. Okay, so is that acceptable? Okay, well, I just wanted to make sure we had that discussion. Any other things that you want to bring up, John or Mary, about that? Are you guys okay with that kind of process going forward?
Yeah, that's fine with me. We had talked about it,
My clarification, are we still looking at the third Friday of November and then the third Friday of January? Isn't that what our current schedule
that's is? That's how we've been doing it. And, you know, obviously there's a challenge for everybody's schedule.
So that'll be November 21 and then January 1, 2, the 16th. And I can tell you the January 16th date is going, they will have just come back in for session that Monday. So we might have
Make sure we supply coffee.
Yeah, right. The room thing might be a dilemma because they'll be doing a lot of new member training and things like that after they're sworn in, and the building will be much busier. But it'll be open lots earlier.
There you go. It works well for me.
You won't be locked out if you want to meet at 7:30. I'm just kidding. I would have missed October anyway. I was in D.C., so there you go. All right, I just
okay, very good. Well, then, and I sort of apologize for going out of order, but I just want to make sure while Senator was here that we had that discussion. So in our time remaining, what we wanted to do is sort of open back up the report. And in the interim, we've done some, we've taken the edits, basically, or all of the suggestions that were brought forth. And Sandy spent a lot of time doing some editing of the work that, and the recommendations that came out. So we wanted to kind of walk through some of the edits and make sure that the language still is reflective of our conversation. One of the things that was called out, so what I'd like to do is just briefly look at the first section because we did make some clarification on some terminology in the first section, and I wanted to make sure the group was comfortable with that approach. One of the issues that has been a challenge for us is the whole issue of payment parity versus fair compensation, and so we thought that introduction of language that really reflected our intention to make sure compensation was fairly administered for the services provided. We've kind of made a little bit of a shift, and I just wanted to get some feedback from the group to make sure, because the message that you send out with that is perhaps a little different. Payment parity elicits some different sort of responses depending on the audience, so just we wanted to bring that out. And then the other issue that we had talked about was really making sure we call to attention to the legislature that there are other groups of providers that really have been affected by payment challenges, and particularly not just the physician, nurse practitioner, and PA group. And we wanted to call that out so that we made sure that how that would be addressed and put it back in the legislature's hands to be able to make sure that that group, because it clearly came out in testimony that that was another part of the workforce that was challenged by the reimbursement system. So I just wanted to open that up. I want to, is there any feedback with respect to, I mean, it's a subtle change, but I just want to make sure folks feel comfortable with that language change related to payment parity versus fair compensation.
You know, I'm not, and again, everybody's going to define a little bit differently probably, so I'm not, in my mind, pay parity indicates a levelness to it that not necessarily fair, if we talk about fair payment. I mean, fair payment could be payments at different levels that would be viewed as fair justification for different things. And so if we talk about pay parity, that I think those are two different things, frankly, but I may be missing something here. Coming from a long string working in the private sector where we argued over whether it's fair pay or not, I'm just trying to, because when I talk about pay parity, I'm talking about being the same, the people receiving the same levels of compensation for the same codes, and I don't see that necessarily if I say fair payment, but that's me.
Any other comment around the language?
Started
it. Yeah, and it is consistent with the language in the bill. So we had just sort of the common vernacular had been that the payment parity. We also are looking at a specific population of providers as well. So I think the intention was just to make sure that we are assured that providers, in fact, receive fair compensation for their work. And that's to, you know, that would be determined by their specialty and the level of service. So if there's no other, I certainly appreciate the content session. We'll have some further background. But at this point, I wanted to make sure that we included some language related to practitioners. It's now listed as Task Force Recommendation 5. And so so I wanted to just open it up for discussion whether we felt that this was the most appropriate section to put that, to call that out again, or if you want to put that in the workforce section, but we just want to make sure it was called out. So
I think it's very appropriate in the pay parity section. I think by putting it in pay parity, you're in essence putting it in workforce.
but you're acknowledging that the issue around there is a pay parity issue. I think it's very important to get that piece in there, because I think, like I've said in the past, the bulk of these types of services being provided in primary care are being provided by psychologists, social workers, LPCs, and LMFTs. And that's not even on our radar screen.
Yeah.
So we need to keep it there. And whether it's this committee that addresses it or some other type of committee, as you and I have talked about, whether it's this committee or some other committee, I really don't care, but it's something we need to get addressed and get in there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But putting it in this section, are we implying that similar parity needs to prevail to a marriage counselor?
Well, again, we were looking at, that's why we put it under.
I don't know if people would interpret it that way.
That's, again, part of the reason we moved it back to the original language of fair compensation.
Yeah.
Again, because they're different types of services that are provided by different types of providers.
A marriage counselor is very different than what a PA would be doing in a visit. So. Yeah.
Oh, and I don't disagree with you. I think it has to do with a PA and a nurse practitioner are going to use different codes. And they're going to be eligible to use different codes. And this isn't recommending that they can use codes that they wouldn't necessarily be able to use. Mm-hmm. It's more about the ability. And there's got to be a separate piece of enabling legislation around the standards of care for the provision of behavioral health and primary care. We don't have standards of care for the provision of that service to begin with, to say these are the competencies somebody needs to have in order to perform that, even in terms of basic licensure. So I think that's a separate issue from this committee. But at least it puts the recommendation in there that we acknowledge it. And I agree that it's not about parity. It's about even being able to do it to begin with. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So any other discussion on that? Folks feel comfortable with putting that language into that? We just felt that it was really important to call that as one of our recommendations. Okay, let's move into the workforce piece. We have made a couple of just sort of editorial changes related to just common language just to reflect. Again, the challenge with a patient-centered medical home or a patient-centered primary care home is the language just changes all the time, and nobody...
Statute. Huh? This is an Oregon statute.
Yeah, it is an Oregon
statute. That's where we came up with it. We didn't...
The
patient-centered primary care home is the statutory language in Oregon versus
Correct.
The rest
so
of the
we just need to make sure it's in alignment with the language, because reality is it's all over the map in literature. It's all over the map in the common vernacular. So again, we just need to make sure it's in our language of our report. We're using
the accepted
vernacular. So it was more of an editorial change, and appreciate the ONA for calling that out. So the recommendations related to workforce are on page 5. And so I wanted to open up again to discussion related to those components. And just to remind the group, again, our recommendations are to support the current work of the OHA and particularly the Workforce Committee, which was the reason that we had them come today, is to understand the scope and the breadth of the analysis that they're doing of the workforce, and to try to understand how are they going to predict what the necessary workforce is over time. So again, as well as other statewide initiatives, and many are aware of a variety, and Dr. Smith has been kind enough to point out several different efforts that are really looking at the workforce challenges at a variety of levels. The OMA is involved in workforce evaluation, as is the ONA, as is every specialty society related to primary care and behavioral health, because clearly the workforce challenges in Oregon are significant. So we wanted to call that out. That we wanted to continue to support that work, and particularly as it pertains to the shortage areas, the areas that are really challenged geographically. And then the other issue that we didn't really address was, call out per se, was the populations that potentially that they are addressing with respect to some of those other disparities. So, and I appreciated that they have really are taking a look at the provider complement to make sure that it matches the needs of the populations that they're serving. So that was the first recommendation. Any comment as to the wording in that recommendation? Everything look okay? And again, just like we did last time, many people go home and ruminate or think about stuff, and then come back with some additional language. So Sandy is more than happy to the edit wizard. So we'll have her. So please let us know if you have additional edits going over time, even if they're grammatical, but certainly if they have substantial content or you want to make sure there's something else that needs to be addressed.
Hopefully we won't go all the way back to the first one.
Yeah. We're slowly migrating through, and I think we're going to get to where we need to be. Second item, any comment, Mary or John?
No.
I don't want to forget the small box on the table, so.
So I
apologize if I do.
I have a quick question on number four when it talks about increasing funding for residency training programs. We're talking about increasing funding for all three of those disciplines, not just MDs, right?
Right. I think it's just
MDs, DOs. MPs and PAs?
Yes. I mean, as far as what categories of physician, you're saying whether it's a DO or MD program?
No, I'm just making sure that we're covering MPs and PAs and everybody else in that recommendation.
If you look at number four, I think it does that.
I think that there was, primary care behavioral health training programs for NPs and PAs. We tried to really call that out because, again, as I look at the workforce going forward, there's going to be a greater and greater dependency, particularly in primary care and behavioral health, on a team-based model. The traditional, Norman Rockwell model is probably not going to be, the model of the future. So we want to make sure that we have adequate training programs and availability for those key providers. Yeah, Robin?
And I think it's just, okay.
Is that not strong enough
language? I think it needs to be, where I'm getting confused is when you look at, okay, with MDs, it's like talking about everything, right? And when you look at MPs and PAs, it seems to pigenhole it to primary care behavioral health.
Oh, so increased funding. That's a good point.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, increased funding for primary care and behavioral health.
Because the intention was specifically to call out the training programs for behavioral health and primary care.
Not trying to get more cardio.
All three of those categories. Yeah, so good call out.
You're not trying to get more neurologists, per
se. Well, yeah.
Orthopedic surgeons.
Well, not that we couldn't use some.
Yeah. I certainly don't think that we need more orthopedic surgeons right now.
I don't either.
But I think, doesn't number four already point out that it's primary care and mental health training programs for the MPPA?
But not for the
not
physicians.
For the physicians. Oh, gotcha. For the physicians, it says everybody, so we get out of it.
Gotcha.
But we'll just clarify that it's for the residency training program.
Yeah. I kind of thought that was implied. I think we need to have it written. You're right.
otherwise, we're going to have more.
Yeah.
And item three, this kind of was reflected in some of the discussion, is, again, it's not just expanding and funding the payment programs. I think given the testimony of this group, it may be helpful to include some of the language of the other incentive. They call them incentive programs as opposed to just calling out just specifically loan repayment programs, that they have tax incentives. They have a variety of other types of incentives. And I think as I looked at this this morning and was thinking about what they were saying is that probably what we really need to do is really look at the incentive program as a whole. The other piece is how is that communicated? How is it accessed? Is it are the barriers to access to those types of incentives, are we making sure they are available to people considering practice in Oregon? So maybe we can expand that language.
On the report that I saw, it gives all that information, how to access, who's it available to, what it is. It's really, really a great report, and I'll make sure you get that.
Great. And they title it incentive.
It's loan repayment incentives, et cetera. Yeah.
Okay. So we'll just make sure the language is consistent. And then also I think either access to it or we need to figure out some wording.
The other thing I was going to suggest is there an appendix we could put a page of all the links and
absolutely.
All the resources that we've, so that future, the legislative staffers and others have that same wealth of information that we've been exposed to.
And I'm not sure when you say the information getting out there, are you talking about like the institutions making the information available to like the applicants, the students? Is it through flyers? And I'll look at the report and see how that is. But is that when you were saying?
Well, most of the students today, unless it comes on their phone, they don't know that it exists. So clearly flyers are probably not going to.
Couldn't you just say expand, fund, and promote?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Expand, fund, and promote.
Yeah, and I think
right.
That would be good language, yeah.
incentive programs such as loan repayment programs. You know, see X document for details.
So when I read this, so the question I had, because it talks about include all communities, so is there some exclusion currently in those programs?
Well,
that would apply to some
Dr. Smith can talk a little bit about that.
I don't think there's exclusions. I think it's more that some communities have done their own thing and other ones haven't because they don't perhaps have the resources to.
Yeah.
So I don't. I think the concept might be more that make sure that they're available across the state.
Right.
And I think that some of the other challenges that were brought out were that even in some parts of the urban environment, which may not in total have shortage, but in certain defined areas do. So if you're going to care for the inner city poor and that's your practice, but you live in an environment in which it's not, there is no shortage, then you know, are there options for you? And I think that was one of the things that was called out in the testimony, that we may have some gaps, particularly in certain care for certain demographics. So, I'm not sure how to word that, but that I think is part of the intention.
I'm certainly supportive of that. I'm just trying to understand if there's something in the past that created an exclusion.
Is there a barrier?
Right.
No,
I'm supporting that.
The barrier, perhaps, lack of dollars.
Yeah.
No, there are specific criteria for tax incentives. And certain areas of shortage that are eligible for those things. But again, the question is there are there populations or areas where we're really not able to take advantage of those that actually probably need more help? And
sometimes the federal programs are very, you know, defined, and you know what, you know, urban is all the way out to Mount Hood, and we know that it's not. So.
Yeah.
So again, how do you know? I just think we need to continue to try to address that, because there may be provider shortages and that we're struggling with. So.
So do you want to completely reword number 3 and number 4, or what? Actually, we're just talking about, because if we're going to expand, fund, and promote, and then instead of using all communities, you were talking about statewide or something,
or to ensure access to throughout Oregon, something like that.
Okay,
I would agree with that.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if there's a sort of an appeals process or a waivers process or something where, say, you were, you know, not in a shortage area, but could somehow access that through some sort of process. I don't know if that actually exists. So I don't know how some of the inner city clinics, if they're able to access any of that
funding. On a federal level, I don't think so. Yeah. I mean, there's this federal agency called HRSA, Health Research. I can't ever remember what it means. Gives each state some funding to pay attention to shortage areas, and you know, and so also the Office of Rural Health does more some of that in companionship with what we do in the primary care office, and so. There's just kind of rules and regs that the feds set for some of those. And we try to work, and, you know, if you kind of, you know, we've actually optimized them quite a bit over the last few years to be as, to try to, like, National Health Service core designations and all that sort of flow from that. But I can't say that they're, I think you can sometimes appeal if they, you know, for like they want to take away a designation, you can appeal and make your case stronger that it is really a shortage area, you know, that sort of thing. But
so there is some
of the federal ones
are
that way. Now, whether there's local efforts by a hospital system, health system, those are, you know, totally, you know, couldn't speak to what their specific requirements are.
I don't know if there's under the federally qualified health centers, whether or not there's any flexibility they have.
Well, that's the one I was referring to, the first group sort of falls into that federal bucket.
They would
where
fall into that bucket.
Yeah. So where we set the sort of calculate the designation, but we have to follow the federal rules. So.
Well, maybe you could think on the language a little bit, and if you have any things to kind of reflect our intent, we just want to make sure that there are, you know, we just want to taking down barriers, particularly to some of those, and then we will want to modify that language in 3. So.
And 4.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to need to go, so thank you to the committee for allowing me to go back to my meeting. And Sandy, you guys can send me the rest of the recommendation.
Excellent. Thank you, Mary.
Great. Thanks, Mary.
Learn lots.
Have a good day.
I can't remember. What state is she in?
Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania, yeah.
There you go.
But what does number two mean, per se? I know the workforce committee touched on it briefly. There is some collaborations going on some things. So is it that you want the legislature to develop options, or do you want them to encourage, or and what's your actual ask?
Encourage is probably more, I think, what the intent was. Again, I think it was really look for community.
You want them to set some, what the options were for the partnerships? It seems like the partnerships come together. You want them to come together and brainstorm locally what would best serve their communities. So I just was trying to figure out how best to word that particular one and what you were thinking when we wrote it that way the first time.
Well, certainly, I think in our original discussion, it really had been that of encouraging strategic funding partnerships. I think that the idea was, I think as we've looked at it, and I know Robin said the same issue where she's at, you know, it's really required sort of public-private partnership in order to try to create sort of incentives or ways to actually bring workforce and better support that. And even the business community, you know, looking at options for housing, looking at a whole variety of other things to try to get providers to come to Oregon. So again, whatever wording that we can put in there, we want to really try to encourage those sort of partnerships in recruitment and retention efforts. I don't think we really want to legislate that per se or mandate that, but somehow I think the language is to try to encourage that.
What I do remember from the report that we will get you, I keep saying that, was that they do talk about various reasons to retain these people, such as, you know, are there things for the spouses to do? Is there something for families to do? And how do we keep them once we have got them? Because they were saying that the average person that comes in on these special incentives tends to stay anywhere from 2 to 3 years and then leave. So they're trying to retain those that stay here. And they're looking at different family and social things that would keep people in the rural areas. And again, that'll be in that report that we will link you to. And I know that Elizabeth's going to link you so you can get them the link out to everybody else.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So any ideas on, I like the idea of encourage. I think to develop options, it's probably not going to be the legislature's job.
There was some legislative discussions a couple sessions back about marketing, recruiting, but I think the point of retention is very important, and so I don't know if there's a way to capture that retention
really
is equally as important as getting them here in the first place, which sometimes the incentives get them here, but...
Exactly, keeping them here, and that's something that you read in that report is how what a daunting task that's going to be.
Right,
so.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely, and some of the workforce is by nature migratory. So it's a, you know, many of the hospitalists are, you know, it's part of their career steps, so to speak. Again, it's a challenge to hit all of that. But I think we just want to try to create as many ways to try to support communities and really at a community level. So because that's really where it's going to probably be most effective. Okay, so we'll work on a little bit on the wording on that one as well, and then item five was to investigate through the workforce committee that we just heard any significant barriers for foreign medical graduates, and again that was something that they addressed in their testimony, but it was something that we had sort of called out that those were potential issues, and so what we may do, I don't know if we could do it in appendix, would be to. Get some of the information related to the J-1 visa system or whatnot that may be pertinent to so that the legislators would need to know.
J-1 visa.
Yeah. It's a special visa.
At least we have it in our, because we oversee that program. It's through the Department of Agriculture, and not all states have them, but we've had them for many years. And so if a foreign medical graduate, it's a partnership between the employer who's employing them, and there's a bunch of paperwork they have to do in order to employ them in their offices and stuff. So There's also National Health Service Corps is another active. We're actually very aggressive marketing, you know, the National Health Service Corps. There are certain sites that they're able to get their payback mm-hmm. for their medical school educations.
And PAs are also included in that,
yeah,
too. They,
right.
And I think they only offer it right now to OHSU. I don't think they've reached, I'm not
right.
sure.
I mean, there's a whole web, we have a whole website, and but Lisa and I can get something back to you to kind of summarize something related to that and have the program lead think about what barriers they've run up against.
Right. Because I think we just need to call that out, and then if we can say, you know, have something that says, you know, what's the work going on and what are the potential solutions, because I do it, particularly for the rural communities, it really is challenging. So a lot of paperwork, and they leave the moment you know that visa is up, you know, until how do you hang on to some of these people longer. Are there ways that we can try to incent or expand that exposure, because they're a really valuable part of the workforce, fabulous physicians. So John, you had a comment?
No,
thank you. Okay, so we'll look at that. The last item on there was the support efforts for technical assistance to help providers in primary care and mental health focused clinics to adopt new models of team-based care. And I think that the intention was is that, again, it requires a lot of infrastructure in order to really administer the patient-centered medical home, and we wanted to just make sure that the legislature is aware of that and continues to support those efforts. I mean, it's one thing, you know, the federal incentive payments around high tech and try the institution of meaningful use, qualified and electronic medical records is one thing, but how we actually support that environment and leverage technology, I think we did want to, we just wanted to make sure we called out efforts to try to do that, and didn't know if you had either additional language or ways to express that better, but I think that was the intent, was use of information systems.
I mean, some of the patient-centered primary care home efforts to date have been funded by grants that we've had. So, you know, we have periodically asked to have some additional dollars in the budget focused on that. So.
And again,
there's also the support from the payer, you know, the plans as well as the state program itself. So. You know, I guess I don't know whether that goes here or in the alternative payment methodology, but what you hear from the providers is, how am I going to sustain this? You know, they might have gotten a grant from an insurance company, or they might have, we had some other payments that were there for a while, and now, you know, how do they sustain it going forward? And so how can the payment system change? And maybe we capture that in the next section rather than this section. But,
but maybe we also want to call out sustainable financial models. For, you know,
because it's the long term. You know, once they convert to the model, then how do they sustain it over time? And the payment fee for service payment system doesn't support the behavioral health integrator.
So can we
function.
Say, in number six, and mental health focused clinics to adopt sustainable new models? No.
Well, I just said, guess who are you asking?
Team based care.
Yeah, who are you asking?
Okay.
Really,
so it's a, I think
it's
our intent was to ask the legislators to support the funding and resources able to
right.
enable
right.
these clinics to.
So you want
to
initiate the change and you want to sustain the change. And
right.
So.
But that's a complicated process.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
No question. And I think we can address
telling the legislature to do
and
that is like
be clear that you're asking for
like
financial
saying, here,
support, not
here's
just
a grocery store, make a cake, you know.
Yeah,
the support can be interpreted.
Well
you
we
do have it in
out.
Number two in the next alternative payment support alternative payment methods for services delivered. But maybe there's some in order to sustain the model of that.
But I think we do need to call it out because, you know, the ongoing cost of maintaining, you know, information systems and is huge. And then I think the other piece that we also, you know, the importance of supporting the infrastructure for information exchange, those types of things that really do help the providers. I mean, that's obviously not in the specific to this particular group, but it's pretty important. So, I think we do need to call out that the costs, and the payment models are going to have to be able to help support that ongoing infrastructure cost.
I think that's,
yeah. Well, and you can also, I'm just mentioning, like Janine just said, the public-private partnerships to help support the technical assistance, which then would go to either grants or insurers or CCOs or, whatever you've got.
Which some are already doing, so.
Right, but yeah. if you wanted to call out the relationship in number six, support through public-private efforts for sustainable technical assistance. Yeah. Something like that. I'm trying to capture what you guys are.
So you have technical assistance to adopt, and that you don't really need technical assistance.
Are we on the same one?
Yeah, number six, support efforts.
Workforce or payment?
Workforce.
Okay.
Support efforts for technical assistance, blah, 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 to adopt new methods.
Oh, okay.
So that's what you have right now.
Right.
So, but you don't need technical assistance
really
to
adoption.
Sustain. You need
ongoing funding.
Fund support or sustainable.
And it's really more implementation of the model. I mean, in a lot of ways.
Maintenance.
Yeah, implementation and maintenance of those models. And I think the maintenance piece is something, even the high tech was a chunk of change to get you going, but that ongoing cost of maintaining and developing those records is just huge.
Yeah, and if those costs aren't built into the payment structure, I don't know where you're going to get the money to do it.
Well, I was not as concerned with the IT as I was sustaining having a social worker on site or a behavioral health person on site and some of the data, that time away from patients to look at how to manage a population. Mm-hmm. And there's that aspect of it as well.
And we don't really call that out per se, the population health piece. I mean, the data significance of data, big data, is going to be substantial with population management, and particularly in our area because we're just got back from Madison, Wisconsin with Epic, and the reality is that our systems are largely Epic based, and certainly in the I-5 corridor, and their population management tools are all linked across geography. You can be linked across geography, so with like providers. So the percentage of people that are in our state that are covered by those systems is pretty large. And Ben's taken up, I guess is one of the newest providers taken on the Epic platform. So again, data management, those kind of things ongoing will be a big part of helping sustain primary care and behavioral health and doing that population management. So kind of editorial, but it's a reality is I think we just need to call it that doesn't happen, randomly. Any other items on six? Okay, I think in the.
But we're going to reword six.
We're going to reword six. Yeah, so we'll take those edits, and I would really ask, if you go back through and you go, well, this is really this what we really want to include this language, or this would be better. It's been really helpful to get your edits and comments as we go through, because we really do want this report to reflect, the group and its thoughts. So I really appreciated all the good editing that's happened. Robin?
I just wanted to clarify, and I know we may have hit this while I stepped out of the room briefly, but the initial effort, and you and I talked about this at length, about maintaining the sunset language, I get the intention is to keep so that it keeps the conversation going. But I also just really want to clearly state, I think that's wrong. The sunset language, quite frankly, I think that when we're dealing in the space of MD, PA, and MP, we're starting to get into that old scope of practice conversation that we've been in a million times before. And it's time now that, especially in the space of primary care, we're dying in primary care to have access. The more things that we can do to remove barriers and support NPs and PAs in being able to help with this, the better we're going to be. So I worry personally, and I worry as a task force, about sending a message that we're endorsing and co-signing an old model of thinking, and I worry about pandering to, you know, larger groups that have more power who are able to say, no, we got to keep this sunset in. Let's be really clear. I get why we want to do it, but let's change the language so that our intention maintains, so that we're not looked as co-signing on that, because that'll be hard for me to defend.
I agree.
Do you have proposed language that you want
to
use?
Well, Rick and I talked a little bit about this morning. He's going to give another shot at it.
Okay.
We're in the same place, but it's difficult, but it's hard.
And again, we want the report to the legislator to really reflect our concerns and how important issues, particularly as we get to the payment reform piece, because again, we're chipping around the edges of a fee-for-service system that has got us to where we are. And so in order to, you know, make sure that we're really getting to where we need to go, it's going to require a different payment system. So again, we just want to make sure that the report reflects our sense of urgency around doing that, and that the maintenance of the sunset language is really intended to reflect that we really do want to keep this front and center, and that these issues around reimbursement are important, and we don't want to just sort of put this to bed without addressing some of those other bigger issues. So we'll work on some language to try to reflect that, and certainly if you guys have input, it would be helpful. So thank you, Robin.
You're welcome.
Okay, I think the best course of action here, we have just maybe 10 minutes left, and I think that the utility of our time, what I think we may do is our next section is going to be really dealing with our findings related to some of the alternative payment model issues. We do have a group that is that's been sort of tasked at looking at sustainable healthcare expenditure in the state. Again, one of the policy board subcommittees. Now I found out this morning is not a standing committee. Has addressed some of those issues, and I think that their testimony may be very helpful to try to understand how they're looking at creating long-term, sustainable, from a financial standpoint, models. And then perhaps entering into some of the discussion related to some of the work on the CCO side, I think will be helpful for our discussion next time. So what I think in the interest of time, what I'd like to do, if it's okay with you guys, is really go ahead and kind of wrap up and then look at this payment model. In addition to at our next meeting in November, take on that section and we'll bring back those other things. Are there, as you guys look at the folks that you want to hear from related to that issue, are there other groups that you would want to hear from? We were hoping to get the sustainable healthcare expenditure work group to be able to present their findings. Are there other groups, do you know, that we would want to bring into that discussion next time?
Well, again, that group is more the bigger looking. It's not focused on primary care or behavioral health payments,
right,
per se. So just that context, it's in response to the governor's request to the policy board to address, you know, continue to how would we monitor things as these changes occur. So it's way up here. So just with that, it's not necessarily going to help. And so I don't know if the committee needs more understanding of the potential alternative payment methods, or there isn't.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a variety of ways to. There's materials available mm-hmm. from the multi-payer consensus group. That's the payers and the OMA and ONA, and everyone was on that sort of thing.
The multi-payer group, who leads that consortium?
Well, it was just a one-time activity that has probably come back together to see where we're at on it. It was facilitated by the Center for Evidence-Based Policy, Pam Curtis, in partnership with the Health Leadership Council and the Health Authority.
That may be helpful to try to understand how they looked at that work and what their recommendations coming out.
I mean,
of that.
It was endorsing the patient-centered primary care home as sort of the thing everyone would sort of point to for their payments, and then agreement that they would, you know, want to support the payments going forward. I mean, that with that infrastructure, you know, helps sustain the infrastructure, et cetera.
Well, what we can do is really maybe what we can talk as well and see who would be. Are there additional groups or work that we want to bring into that discussion in November?
It wasn't as focused on behavioral health per se. It was more because the patient-centered primary care home payments that we had through the federal ACA were ending. You know, what was was to have a community discussion about that amongst the payers and the providers. But it wasn't as, again, not focused on behavioral health per se.
I wonder, is there any utility in, you know, the CPCI grant program?
I mean, that's paying 67, that's a partnership with Medicare. It's to those clinics that were selected by the feds. Again, it's not necessarily behavioral health focused.
You know, it's pretty primary care focused, yeah. Though. And then and the primary care focus was an integrated model. I'm just wondering if there's, we can talk offline too and then try to see who, if there's additional information that would help us as we try to look at our recommendations and, you know, are there things.
I don't know if there's some innovative, I know Robin, you've been doing some innovative behavioral health payments that are different, you know, that are a little more focused on that behavioral health integration aspect. Than either of these other two things.
Oh yeah,
per se.
And it's actually been been broader than that. And if you're interested in November, by the time November rolls around, we'll have nearly 3/4 of data. It's been looking at the whole primary care payment, including behavioral health. But it's been really interesting results. We're right now, I think the last reports that I saw, we were within $500,000 of where we should be as a system. And it's very, it's a little different than what our scope is, but it's inclusive. And I would be more than happy to set that up.
Isn't that based on the Colorado model?
A little bit. We took it a little bit farther because we include the hospital. So there's the primary care risk capitation, and then there's the hospital risk capitation. So we went Colorado and took it one step further. We also call it jumping off a cliff. But you're happy.
Most folks aren't really excited about that option, you know, maybe other than the South Pacific or something. Where
is an example of an alternative payment approach being practiced or tried in the state about how to be more encompassing. But
we're actually doing Karen Shepherd, our CFO, is doing a presentation on it Tuesday at the OHSU conference.
But what we may consider, we'll talk a little bit as well, maybe Robin, it might be helpful to either have Karen or you come and explain it. I think it's good to see what's actually happening and that change can happen and that there's, you know, some potential for really looking at the way we reimburse much differently and that it can be, that's doable. So, because I think that part of the challenge of this whole thing is it just seems so daunting to fundamentally shift to a different payment model that, you know, that fear of movement is you know, kind of paralyzing, I think, in a lot of sectors. So to see, you know, a group actually make something happen and happen in a relatively short time, I think is, you know, encouragement that, you know, we can, in fact, fundamentally change payment systems in the state on a shorter time frame than perhaps other areas in the country. So maybe what we'll do is talk about what possible options we might have to bring in some of that kind of let's think out of the box sort of stuff, and then also in the box, what are the possibilities? Any other topics that you would want to bring for next time? Okay.
No. Oh, well. For next time.
For next time.
And well, Coralie has a topic to mention.
Coralie, also, I'm going to, we got just 5 minutes left. Coralie's been kind enough to put together some, we had requested some information related to physician assistants. And so, Coralie, I'm going to hand it over to you, and you can enter your statement into the work.
We have, Oregon Society of PA, we put together a little addendum that we'd like to have included in there as far as the language on supervision for physician assistants. It's very clearly laid out on the Oregon Medical Board ORS, and so we just kind of wanted to include that in there to help us with the language of understanding the supervision aspect of PAs.
So thank you for taking the time to do that, because it was something we asked and we appreciate that clarity, because again, it's it is a little bit more straightforward than some of the other relationships, but it's important to understand what that looks like. So thank you.
And I'll make sure that Dr. Gluckman is aware that it's out there, because he had some questions last week.
He had some questions, So we'll make sure he's aware of it, as well as making sure that we include that information in the appendix as well.
We're going to have a big appendix.
Yeah, we are. Okay, any other concerns or things that, for the good of the order, that you want to bring before we close up?
When you let Bob know, you should probably also ask, let him know what sections he has thoughts on. Be good to get the insurer's perspective on the language on that section on workforce.
Okay, yeah. So I think Bob's been given, and John, you've had a chance to look at the language as well, so we want to make sure that you guys give us input as well.
Are you there, John?
I'm not sure we still have him. He's probably off and off to another meeting. Okay, we're going to go ahead and adjourn. And adjourn. Ahead.